to do that. The steward shrugged. Detlef realized that the man was enjoying this brief taste of command. For once, he was at the center of things, not a simple creature of Oswald's.
There are many possibilities, Mr. Siak. A religious ritual dedicating the sacrifice to some dark god. A wizard needing the material for a spell. Many enchantments require peculiar ingredients. Or it could be the work of a madman, an obsessive who kills in a bizarre manner in an attempt to tell us something.
Like, eat less and take more exercise, I suppose. This is insane, Crayley. A man is dead.
Genevieve took his hand. That helped somehow. He calmed down.
I'm sorry.
The steward accepted his apology without sincerity.
At the risk of being obvious, we must face facts. There is a murderer among us.
They all looked at each other again, like participants in one of those dim, haunted castle melodramas in which the cast drop dead at regular intervals until the High Priest of Moor deduces who the killer is and the audience wakes up.
And we must catch him without word of our troubles reaching the outside.
I beg your pardon?
Whatever we do must be done in secret. The Crown Prince would not want this to disrupt the smooth running of his play.
I am here to deal with just such occurrences. You need not concern yourself. Know only this, that I will work to bring the murderer to justice as soon as possible.
Bruegel spoke up.
Detlef, it might indeed be best to leave this to the prince's men. But we can't just go on as if nothing has happened.
Can't we? By my interpretation of the Crown Prince's orders, we have no other course open to us.
Nebenzahl was still shaking and moaning. Detlef nodded in his direction.
And how do we keep the popinjay silent?
Crayley's mouth did something that in another man might qualify as a smile.
Mr. Nebenzahl has just been recalled to Altdorf. He left early this afternoon and has written to his employer severing their relationship.
The astrologer started and stared at the steward.
I am given to understand that many who quit Miss Lily Nissen's employ choose to leave in a similar manner.
Nebenzahl looked like a man just informed of his impending death.
Don't worry, gut gazer, said Crayley. You'll be better paid for shutting up and going away than you would have been for staying around and blabbering to everyone. I believe a position could be found for you in Erengrad.
The halberdier left the room, pulling Nebenzahl along with him. Detlef wondered how the weedy little fraud would get by among the Norsemen and Kislevites of that cold port on the borders of the northern wastes. He was furious with Crayley by now, but had learned to be cool in his wrath. Nothing would be achieved if he threw a screaming fit like Lily Nissen.
And I'm supposed to continue with the play. And incidentally, it is my play, not Crown Prince Blessed Oswald's, while people are being slaughtered all the while.
Cray was resolute.
If the Crown Prince so wishes it.
I wonder, my dear steward, if Oswald would entirely approve of your actions.
This gave Crayley pause, but he soon snapped back.
I'm sure the Crown Prince has every confidence in me. He did assign me these duties. I believe I have not been a disappointment to him in the past.
Genevieve had walked back to the table and was taking a close look at what was left of Rudy. For the first time, Detlef realized fully that no matter how she seemed, the woman wasn't human. She had no fear of the dead, and indeed must have some familiarity with them.
What are you doing? Asked Crayley.
Feeling for something.
Genevieve touched the corpse's head and shut her eyes. She might be praying for his soul, Detlef supposed, or doing arithmetic in her head.
No, she said after a time. He's gone.
Nothing remains of his spirit.
Did you hope to read his murderer's face in his mind? Crayley asked.
Not really.
I just wanted to say farewell. He was a friend of mine, in case you'd forgotten. He had a hard life and was not well served by it. She left the body alone. One thing, she said.
Yes?
You are aware of the common superstition that a dying man's eyes hold the last sight he beholds, that a murderer may be betrayed by his image in his victim's pupils. They all looked at Rudy's face, at his empty eye sockets and flenched cheeks.
Of course!
Crayley was impatient now. It's rot. Physicians and alchemists no longer think quite, the foolishness of another age, like the belief that toadmen from the stars ruled the world before the coming of chaos.
Besides, his eyes are gone.
That is precisely the point I wish to make. You and I know the story of the murdered man's eyes is nonsense, but Rudy's murderer might believe it. That would explain why he took the eyes. Crayley was taken with the thought.
A superstitious man, then? A gypsy? Or an Östlander?
I make no accusations.
Perhaps a dwarf. They are known for their superstitious ways. Brass pennies for luck. Black cats drowned at birth.
Bruegel bridled as Crayley turned to him.
I'm no dwarf, he spat. I hate the little bastards.
Crayley waved his protest away.
Still, the vampire lady has a point. My lady, your intuitions are as sharp as they are said to be.
There's another possibility, said Detlef, that this was done by no human agency. The supernatural is no stranger to these walls. Drachenfels was famed as a conjurer of demons and monsters. They were supposed to have been cleared out, but it's a huge building. Who knows what could have lived here all these years, festering in the dark, waiting for its master's murderers to return?
Genevieve touched a finger to her chin, obviously following Detlef's train of thought. She shook her head slightly, unsure.
And we have brought back all the survivors of Oswald's adventurers as easy meat.
Detlef was concerned for Genevieve, for Manesh and Veit too. But Crayley had a single thought.
The Crown Prince must be warned. He might not wish to come.
Genevieve laughed.
You really don't know your master very well, do you, Crayley?
This would only make him the more determined to be here.
You could be right, my lady. Rest assured, I'll charge the guards with extra vigilance. This will not happen again.
You have my word on it. 10. Alone in his room, Varga Bruegel drank and looked at himself in the mirror. He did not know who had assigned the various quarters for the company, and assumed no cruel slight had been intended. But his was the only bedroom he had seen here equipped with a floor-to-ceiling mirror. This must have been where some harlot witch painted and primped. The great enchanter had had many mistresses down through the millennia. Unlike Varga Bruegel in his meagre 47 years. Moonbeams filtered down through the windows and lit the room, casting a baleful light over everything. Bruegel sat in his chair, feet dangling a hand's span above the carpet, and looked himself in the eye. He remembered his parents and the air of disappointment that always hung about them. His sisters, born before him, were above average height. His younger brother had been as tall, straight, and handsome as anyone could wish, until he fell in battle in the service of the Emperor, giving their parents another reason to be uncomfortable in his presence. His mother and father had blamed each other for his condition and had spent their lives searching each other for signs of the deformity that had been passed down through their mating to their son. Of course, it had been embarrassing for them to explain to all callers at their home that no, they didn't have a dwarf servant, they had a dwarf son, and he wasn't a true dwarf, he was a midget. he started his second bottle. He was drinking sloppily now. There were stains on his shirt. His skin itched under his clothes, and he wriggled. He had run away and joined a travelling circus, become a clown. Soon he was running his own circus, although he had full-sized men to deal with people, and branching out into the theatre. There had been true dwarf clowns working in his circus, but they had not accepted him as one of their own. Behind his back or to his face, they called him a freak and a warped monstrosity, which is what he was. He had no wife, no mistresses, and bathed in private. His body was a secret, and he kept it well. But he examined himself daily for new changes. Often there were two or three a month, and with the changes came new abilities, new senses. The tubers under his arms, held together by bat-like webbing, could tune into people's emotions. He always knew how others felt, to what degree they were disgusted by him. So far, his face had not been affected, but he had had to wear gloves for some years now to cover the eyes in the palms of his hands, the eyes that could see sounds. He was a midget. He was also an altered and a freak. There was a new word for what he was. He had heard scholars use it, first of plants cultivated unnaturally, then of two-headed calves, wall-eyed dogs and the like, and now of humans, affected by the warpstone progressing beyond their flesh, becoming creatures of chaos. Varga Bruegel was a mutant. 11. Karl Franz I, of the House of the Second Wilhelm, protector of the Empire, defier of the dark, emperor himself and the son of emperors, had come calling on the palace of von Königswald. The foyer table was piled high with black-edged condolence cards delivered by messenger, but Karl Franz laid his down in person. He brushed aside the stewards and guards and walked briskly through the palace in search of the new elector. Others would have visited Oswald, the grand theogonist of the cult of Sigmar and the high priest of the cult of Ulrich would have endeavoured to be polite to each other throughout the lying in state of the old elector, Maximilian. Representatives of the city-states and the electoral provinces, emissaries from the major temples of Altdorf and the halfling Moot would have called with messages of sympathy. Karl Franz came alone, without the usual pomp that accompanied his every move, and saw Oswald man to man. There were few others in the land who could warrant such treatment. The emperor found Oswald in Maximilian's study, Oswald's study now, going through old papers. Oswald dismissed the secretaries and ordered wine to be brought.
"Your father was a great friend to me when I was a boy, Oswald. In many ways he meant more to me than my own father. It's difficult to rule an empire and be the head of a family, as I know too well. Maximilian will be greatly missed."
"Thank you." Oswald was still withdrawn, moving as if in a dream.
"And now we must think of the future. Maximilian is buried with honour. You must be confirmed in the crown as soon as possible."
Oswald shook his head. This must be difficult for him. Karl Franz remembered the agonising ceremony that had surrounded his own ascendance to the throne, the days of torture as the electors debated the succession. He had never believed the verdict would be for him. He understood through his own sources that the voting had been 8-4 against on the first ballot, and that Maximilian had talked round all but one of the other electors by the end of the session. If he truly ruled, rather than held together a squabbling collection of principalities, then he ruled only on the sufferance of the House of von Königswald.
"The coronation will be at Castle Drachenfels, after the play. The electors will all be there, and the other dignitaries. We should have no need to reassemble them a few weeks later for another of these stately ordeals.
You are right, of course, Oswald. But an empire expects due ritual process. Ruling is not enough. One must be seen to rule.
Oswald looked up at the portrait of his father in his prime. He had a falcon on his hand and stood in the woods at the forefront of a group. A golden-haired child was by his side, the young Oswald.
I never noticed before that youth taking the bird. He's dressed as a falconer, but...
Karl Franz smiled.
Yes, it's me. I remember those days well. Old Luitpold disapproved. What if the future emperor should fall from his horse, or lose an eye to an angry bird, or get stuck by a boar? He thought the future emperor should be treasured like a painted egg. Your father understood these things better.
Yes, I believe he did.
And already I see signs that young Luitpold thinks of you as I thought of your father. Maybe I too try to cosset and smother the future emperor. I hope I'm not the domestic tyrant old Luitpold was, but I see all the signs around me. Circles come around between our houses.
It was an impressive painting. Karl Franz wished he could recall the artist. He must have been one of Maximilian's hunting friends. He had certainly had a feel for the forests. You could almost hear the wind in the trees, the cries of the birds.
Soon we'll be in the woods again, Oswald, on the road to Drachenfels. There'll be good hunting along the way. I must confess that when you proposed the trip, I wasn't sure about it. But I've always wanted to see the site of your great victory. And I'm weary of the stifling comforts of palaces and courtiers. It's been too long since we stalked a stag or sang the old songs. And I was sorry that your friend Sierk's History of Sigmar fell apart. Middenland sank a sum of money in it, you know. I've been looking forward to seeing the fellow act. The ladies of my court tell me he's quite the thing.
Yes, Emperor.
Emperor and Elector, eh? I remember when we were just Karl Franz and Oswald. There's one thing I've always wondered, though.
What, Emperor?
When we were young men, when our fathers said you were mad to go up against the great enchanter.
Yes.
Why did you not ask me to come along? I'd have danced for the chance of such an adventure, such a battle.
Act 4. 1. Detlef was not sleeping well. He had retired early, not wishing to be pulled back to the mundane business of the company and the play after having seen what was left of Rudy. Now he lay awake in bed, wishing, as he had done more than once since this thing began, that he was back in his cell at Munzen Keep. At least Sharadat had been someone to hate. And he could see Sharadat, understand his petty nastiness. There weren't any phantom monks pointing their ghostly fingers in Munzen Keep. And there weren't any fat-taking, eyeball-gouging killers, either. Indeed, compared to the fortress of Drachenfels, the keep had been a resort. Perhaps Detlef would turn his prison experiences into the subject of a farce one day, with the wily debtors outwitting the comically dim trustees and the pompous governor being forever humiliated by his charges. It was no use. He could not think of the comic mask tonight. Not only might there be a madman among them, prowling the darkened corridors of Castle Drachenfels, but also he was worried that Henrik Crayley, Oswald's man, was a potential tyrant who would rather risk the lives of everyone in the company than inconvenience the Crown Prince in any way. Taradash had said, "A patron is a man who watches you drowning for 20 minutes and, when you finally manage to drag yourself to the shore by your own efforts, burdens you with help." With the Elector of Middenland and the History of Sigmar, and now the Crown Prince of Östland and Drachenfels, Detlef appeared to be making a specialty of distinguished backers and doom-haunted productions. He liked Oswald, but he had no illusions about his own importance in the Crown Prince's ultimate schemes. The only comfort he could take was that, apart from Lily Nissen, the play was coming along startlingly well. If they all lived through it, Drachenfels would make their reputations. Laszlo Lohenstein was a revelation. When the play transferred to an Altdorf theatre, Detlef would insist that Lohenstein go with the package. After the performance, he would be a leading light of the stage. Next time, Detlef would consider stepping back to write and direct only, and create a real vehicle for the man's astonishing talents. There weren't any good histories of Boris the Incompetent, and Lohenstein might be right for such a tragic figure. There could even be a good story in the assassination of Tsarina Catherine by her great-great-grandson, the Tsarevich Pavel, if only Genevieve Dieudonné could be persuaded to play the Tsarina. If only Genevieve Dieudonné could be persuaded to play herself. She'd certainly be less of a pain in the fundament than Lily Nissen. Detlef was thinking a great deal of the vampire. He guessed, from the murder of Rudy, that she was in some danger if she remained at the fortress, and he felt an obligation to her. Yet, how could he hope to protect a 660-year-old girl who could crush granite in her bare hands and had already faced the great enchanter and survived? Perhaps he would do better to ask her for protection. And in addition to the unknown murderer, the ghostly monks, and whatever demons might still cling to the stones of Drachenfels, might they not also need protecting from Henrik Krayli? Detlef wished Oswald were here already. He had bested the perils of this place once. Furthermore, Detlef hoped the Crown Prince would be interested to find out what Krayli was doing in his name. When there came a scratching at his door, Detlef clutched the bedclothes to him like a child who has heard one too many ghostly bedtime stories, and his candle fell over. He knew that it was all going to end here, and the ballads would tell of the genius murdered in his bed before his best work could be done.
"It's me,"
hissed a low, female voice. Guessing he would regret it, he got up and unlocked the door. He had to pull a chair out from under the doorknob. Genevieve was outside in the corridor. Detlef was at once relieved and excited by her presence. "Genevieve," he said, opening the wide door. "It's late."
"Not for me."
"I'm sorry, I was forgetting. Do you ever sleep?" Genevieve shrugged. "Occasionally. In the mornings, usually. And not in a coffin filled with my native soil. I was born in Paravon, which was civilized enough even then to pave over their beaten earth roads, so that would be a problem. Come in. Come in." "No, you must come out. There are strange things happening here by night."
"I know. That's why I'm staying locked in my room with a silver throwing knife."
Genevieve winced and made a fist of her right hand. He recalled the story of the treachery of Yuli the dwarf.
"Again, I'm sorry. I should have thought."
She laughed, girlishly.
"No, no. I'm past bothering about all that. I'm a creature of the night, so I have to live with these things. Now, get your clothes on and bring a candle. You probably can't see in the dark as well as I can."
Her voice was light, flirting, but her eyes were serious. There's a strange quality to vampire eyes.
"Very well, but I'm bringing my knife. Don't you trust me?"
Her smile showed teeth.
"Genevieve, just now you and Varga Bruegel are the only people in this place that I do trust."
He pulled on his trousers and a jacket and found a pair of slippers, which wouldn't make too much noise on the naked stone floors. He relit his candle, and Genevieve tugged at his sleeve.
"Where are we going?"
"We're following my nose. I don't smell anything."
"Neither do I. That was a figure of speech. I can feel things, you know. It comes with what I am. There's a great disturbance in this place. When we came here, it was clear, empty. But something came along with us and has taken up residence. Something old, something evil.
The 27th wagon?
Genevieve stopped and looked at him, puzzled.
Remember, we could never get straight the number of wagons in the caravan,
he explained.
There were supposed to be 26, but whenever we weren't looking, there seemed to be 27. If what you're talking about came with us, perhaps it came in that wagon.
That could be so. I should have thought of that at the time. I assumed you were just being artistically inept.
Thank you very much. It takes a lot of ineptitude to stage a major play, let me tell you. If it weren't for Bruegel, I'd be ploughed under with work. It's not all writing and play-acting. There are finances and accommodation arrangements, and you have to feed all these people. There's probably more organization involved than in a military campaign.
They had ventured into a part of the fortress Detlef didn't recognize. It was partially in ruins, and the cool night air blew through gaps in the walls. Moonlight flooded in. Oswald's men had not been here, and there had been no attempt to clean the place up or to make it safe. Detlef realized how little of the structure he had seen and had been given access to.
It's near, Genevieve said, precisely as a gust of wind snuffed his candle.
Very near. He put the warm stub in his pocket and relied on the moon. He couldn't feel, see, or smell anything out of the ordinary.
What precisely are we looking for?
It could be anything, but it's big, it's disturbed, and it's not friendly.
I'm really glad you told me that.
She looked good at night, with her long moonlit hair and floor-length white dress. As dead people go, she was a lot prettier than Rudi Wegner. For a moment, he wondered whether he hadn't been lured to this isolated spot for something more intriguing than a simple exercise in corridor prowling. His blood ran faster. He had never been bled by a vampire, but he had read the erotic poems of Vladislav Voyetsky, Tsarina Catherine's lover, and understood from them that the experience was quite something. He put his hands on her waist and drew close to her, smelling her hair. Then they heard the chanting. Genevieve turned her head and put a finger to her mouth, shushing him. She stepped from his half-embrace and pushed her hair back from her face. Detlef couldn't tell whether she was baring her teeth consciously or unconsciously. They looked longer and sharper in the moonlight. The chanting was only just audible, but it had a horrid quality to it. If this were a religious rite, it would be dedicated to one of the gods whose altars Detlef habitually shunned. If this were some magical incantation, it was the work of an outlaw wizard, conjuring up something utterly vile. Slowly, quietly, they crept down the corridor, passing through alternating patches of light and dark. There were doors in the walls, and one, about 20 feet up ahead, was ajar. The chanting came from beyond that door, Detlef was certain. It grew louder as they approached, and he could make out the low pipe music being played under the vocal. Something about the tune turned his stomach, something that made him fear he had seen his last sunset. They pressed close to the wall and edged nearer. There were lights beyond the door and people moving in a confined space. Detlef had his silver knife out. They came to the door and peered through. The slit only afforded a very limited view of what was taking place inside the chamber beyond. But that was enough to make Detlef feel sick again. In a circle of black candles lay a small figure. A child, or a dwarf. It was impossible to tell, because he had been flayed. His exposed musculature glistened red in the candlelight. Shadows danced around him, cast by unseen participants in this grisly scene.
Manesh, whispered Genevieve.
Detlef saw that the red thing in the circle had but one arm. As he gazed at the writhing snakes of the dwarf's intestines, he came to realize that Manesh was still, somehow, alive. He would have vomited then, but there was nothing left in his stomach to come up. Bones stood out white amid the bloody jelly of the remaining flesh. Genevieve was straining forward, tensing to leap into the room. Detlef held her back by the shoulders. They would have no chance against as many murderers as he thought joined in the chant. She turned and took his wrists. He felt again the strength of the vampire and saw red anger flare and die in her eyes. Then she too realised they couldn't afford to barge in and get killed. She nodded her thanks. Then they heard the clatter of boots. People were coming down the corridor, and they were caught between the two factions. Lanterns came out of the dark. Halberds scraped the stone ceiling. Six men-at-arms marched, and Crayley stood at their head. He looked disapproving as he saw Detlef and Genevieve. For once, Detlef couldn't bring himself to be annoyed by the man's presence. Just now, he looked like the Imperial cavalry turning up in the last act to relieve the castle. The chanting had risen now to a weird ululation that resounded throughout the passageway. Manesh was screaming in time with the music, and the shadows clustered around him.
"What are you doing here?" snapped Crayley. "Never mind that," said Detlef, having to shout now to be heard over the chant. "There's murder being done in this room." "So I gather."
He pushed his helmet back and hooked his thumbs into the pockets of his doublet.
"Crayley, let's end this thing now."
The steward considered a moment or two.
"Very well."
Detlef stood back and let the first pair of Crayley's bully boys crash through the door, knocking it off its hinges. The heavy wood fell with a gust that extinguished the black candles. The chanting and the music shut off suddenly, and there were cries in the dark. Some of the voices were human. Detlef rushed into the room. As he stepped through the portal, the candle he was holding went out, and he found himself in total darkness. He had the feeling of being in a vast, exposed plain, under a starless, moonless night sky. He stepped in something soft and wet and heard a groan that told him what it was. Then he was buffeted this way and that by heavy bodies. There were screams and the noise of weapons clashing. He was lifted bodily from the ground and thrown across the room. He collided with someone and went down, his arm twisted under him. There was a wrenching at his shoulder, and he prayed the bone wasn't broken. Crayley was barking orders. Someone stepped briefly on his chest, and he tried to stand up, clutching his agonised shoulder. Then the lights came in. Genevieve, a lantern in either hand, stood in the doorway. The chamber was small and had a dead dwarf in it. Otherwise, Detlef, Crayley and the men-at-arms were alone. In the dark, one of the Crown Prince's men had been stabbed in the thigh by a comrade and was bleeding messily as he applied a tourniquet. Genevieve went to his aid, and he cringed away from her as she tied the wound properly. The bleeding stopped, and the man seemed somewhat surprised that the vampire let him be.
"Well done, Crayley. Oswald will be proud of you, I'm sure."
Detlef pushed his shoulder back into place, gritting his teeth through the pain. The steward wasn't rattled by his failure. He was on his knees, examining the dwarf. Detlef was upset to notice the footprint in the new-made corpse's stomach and thought better of looking at his own slipper.
"The skin's gone this time, and the kidneys, and the eyes, of course, and, the regenerative organs."
Crayley blushed at having to mention such indecent matters in the presence of a lady.
"He was alive when we came in, Crayley," said Detlef. "We probably trampled him to death."
"He wouldn't have lived."
"Obviously not, but he might have told us something before he went. We've not done well here."
Crayley stood up, wiping the dust from his knee breeches. He pulled out a kerchief and tried to get the blood off his hands. He rubbed away at his fingers long after they were clean.
"There must be another way out," said Genevieve. "I was at the door. No one came through it after you all pushed your way in."
They all looked around the room. It was bare stone, with traces of graffiti in a language or languages Detlef didn't recognise as the only adornment. Crayley gave an order, and his men began prodding with their halberds. Finally, when they tried the ceiling, a stone receded above a blade, and a whole section of the wall swung inwards. Beyond lay a hidden passage, its floor thick with the dust of centuries. The cobwebs had recently been parted.
"You first, Crayley," said Detlef.
The steward, a single-shot pistol in his hand, led the way. Detlef and Genevieve followed, along with four of the halberdiers. They had to leave their halberds behind because the secret passage was too low for the weapons. They all had to stoop.
"This would be a fine escape route for a dwarf," said Crayley.
"Manesh was the victim, not the murderer," mentioned Detlef.
"I wasn't thinking of Manesh."
There was blood in the dust.
"We must have wounded him."
"Either that or he got covered in the stuff while skinning Manesh."
"Possibly."
The passage wound down a spiral staircase into the heart of Drachenfels. They found a skeleton in centuries-old armour. The skull exploded from within. Detlef shuddered. This place had more horrors than the Northern Wastes. Sigmar himself would think twice at exploring its nether regions. There were eye holes in the walls now. Detlef guessed they would peer through the eyes of portraits in the chambers. Either Drachenfels had had a fine sense of irony in his deployment of melodramatic devices, or, more likely, he had invented the clichés later taken up by Adelwitz out to chill the spines of their audiences. The way things were going, he expected a contested will, devious heirs, corpses concealed in suits of armour, and a last act unmasking of the kindly old steward as a mad killer. Then they came to a door and were back in the familiar part of the fortress. This was where the company were billeted.
"Surely that can't be," Detlef said. "We descended to the place where Manesh was killed, and now we've come down again, back to where we were started."
"This place is like that," said Genevieve. "It's all down, whichever way you go."
The door swung back, sealing the secret passage. It looked like any other section of the wall.
"Crayley, weren't you supposed to have someone on guard in this corridor? Someone who might have noticed a murderer covered from head to foot in blood creep out of the wall?"
The steward's face was frozen.
"I had to redeploy my forces to search the castle. That's why you're still alive."
Detlef had to admit he had a point.
"We're alive, yes. But how do we know everyone in these rooms hasn't been slaughtered in their beds? Only with our luck, they'd have spared Lily Nissen."
"Our quarry was in too much haste to do harm to anyone. Look, he left us a spore to read."
There was blood on the carpet. It petered out after a few feet, outside a door. There was a red smear on the knob.
"I believe we have our killer," said Crayley, grimly satisfied.
"Don't you think that's just a bit too convenient?" asked Detlef. "Besides, there was more than one person chanting."
"That's as may be. We'll round up the Confederates later. But first, let's take our man. Or whatever he is."
The door was locked. Crayley discharged his gun at the lock. Others opened up and down the passage, and heads peeked out. Detlef would have to ask later what Kaczynski was doing in Lily Nissen's suite. Crayley kicked the door, and it splintered as it slammed back. Varga Bruegel had jumped out of bed. Crayley looked at him and gasped. Detlef pushed through and felt as if he had been punched in the stomach. His friend and advisor looked up at him through eyes in his chest and hands. But it was the look in the eyes in his face that struck through to Detlef. Bruegel, the monster, was crying.
2.
There is no pleasure like rising with the sun and finding yourself in the forests of the Empire, thought Karl Franz I as he made water in the bushes. He listened to the birdsong, naming each individual species in his head as he distinguished it from the rest of the chatter of the morning chorus. It was a fine spring morning, and the sun was already high, streaming through the tall trees. There would be deer along their route today, the Emperor was sure. It was years since he had hunted deer. In the camp, there were the groans and complaints of those stirred too early from their slumbers. Karl Franz was amused to find which of his distinguished travelling companions awoke irritable in the wilds, which were nursing heads befuddled by last night's food and drink, and which sprang to their horses, enlivened by the call of the birds and the fresh feel of dew underfoot. Herbal tea was being brewed in huge iron pots, and a light breakfast prepared. Some of the worthies chose to sleep in carriages as well-appointed and upholstered as any bedchamber in any palace. But Karl Franz wanted only the feel of a blanket between himself and the ground. The Empress disagreed and had opted to stay at home with one of her persistent illnesses. But Luitpold, their 12-year-old son and heir, was revelling in the freedom of the forests. There were still men-at-arms watching out for the imperial family at every moment. Karl Franz couldn't even wander into the woods to empty his bladder without a sword-bearing shadow following him. But there was open air about them. The Emperor felt free of the burdens of state, felt a respite from the stifling procedures of running the country, of resisting the incursions of evil, of defying the dark. The Elector of Middenland, who had been protesting very loudly ever since he learned precisely who Oswald had engaged to stage his play for him, was rubbing his aching back and moaning softly to the red-haired page who always seemed to be with him. The grand theogonist of the cult of Sigmar, a frail old man for such a robust deity, had not shown a hair of his head outside his coach since they left Altdorf, and his snoring was a source of some amusement. Karl Franz observed the other electors and their attendants as they shook the sleep from their heads and took tea. He was learning more of these men and women upon whom the Empire rested on this trip than he had in years of courtly meetings and grand balls. Aside from Oswald, who rode as if born on a horse and could bring down a pheasant with a single crossbow bolt, the only elector who seemed entirely comfortable on this journey was the elder of the halfling moot, who spent most of his time eating or laughing. The young Baron Johann von Mecklenburg, elector of the Sudenland, was a skilled woodsman, Karl Franz knew, having spent half his life wandering in search of a lost brother and only recently returned to his estates. Johann gave the impression that he had seen things which made pleasure trips like this petty by comparison. He wore his scars like medals and didn't talk much. The Lady Mayoress and Chancellor of the University of Nuln, Countess Emanuel von Liebowitz, rumoured to be the most eligible spinster in the Empire, was not winning any friends with her whining about the tedious details of the hundreds of masks and parties she had thrown. Karl Franz was both amused and appalled at the realisation that the Countess was cooing over Luitpold, not in any motherly sense, but because she regarded the future emperor as an ideal marriage prospect, despite the obvious disparities of age and temperament between them. The emperor took a steaming mug of tea from his attendant and downed a gulp of the hot, sweet beverage. Middenheim was asking how much longer they would be on the road, and Oswald was making a rough guess. Young Luitpold crashed out of the undergrowth, his jerkin soiled and his hair untidy, pushing Resne of Marienburg aside, and bore a still-twitching rabbit to the fire. His arrow had taken it in the haunches. Karl Franz noted that his son took his prize to Oswald for approval. The Crown Prince deftly snapped the dying animal's neck. "Excellent, Highness," said the Elector of Ostland. "This was well shot." Luitpold looked around, grinning, as Oswald tussled his already wild hair. Resne fastidiously brushed his clothes. Oswald waved to Karl Franz. "Your son will feed the Empire, my friend.
I hope so, if it needs feeding.
Talabekland crawled out of his vast tent, bleary-eyed and unshaven. He looked at the bleeding rabbit in Oswald's hand and moaned. Oswald and Luitpold laughed. Karl Franz joined them. This was what the life of the Emperor should always be. Good friends and good hunting. Here. Oswald dipped his hand into the rabbit's wounds and drew red lines on Luitpold's cheeks. Now, future Emperor, you have been blooded. Luitpold ran to Karl Franz and saluted his father. The Emperor returned the salute.
Well, my hero's son, perhaps you should wash yourself off and have some tea. We may rule the greatest country in the known world, but we have an empress who rules us, and she would want you well fed and warmed out here. Husbands have been skewered through the eye with tent pegs for less.
Luitpold took his mug.
Ah, father, but surely Emperor Hjalmar was assassinated for being appallingly ill-suited to the throne, rather than for his shortcomings as a family man. I seem to recall from my lessons that he died childless, and so could hardly be accused of neglecting the welfare of his heirs, unless you count his failure to produce any as a lack of fatherly spirit.
Well learned, my son. Now clean your face and have your tea, before I abdicate in favour of your little sister and cut you out of the succession.
Everybody laughed, and Karl Franz recognised the deep-throated, genuine laughter he could sometimes elicit, rather than the weak chuckles that came from people who believed an emperor's joke was automatically funny and that there would be a penalty of death for anyone who thought differently. There was a neighing as the horses were roused in their makeshift pens by the ostlers.
Father, asked Luitpold, who were the monks who came here last night?
Karl Franz was taken aback.
Monks? I know of no monks. Have you any idea what the lad means, Oswald?
The Elector shook his head, a blank look on his face. Perhaps too blank, as if something were being concealed.
Last night, when all were asleep save the guards, I was awakened,
Luitpold told his story.
I was worried about Fortunato's hoof. His shoe has been working loose, and I thought I heard him whinnying. I got up and went to the pens, and Fortunato was fast asleep. I must have dreamed his cry. But when I returned to my tent, I saw men standing at the edge of the clearing. At first I supposed them to be the guards, but then I noticed they were dressed in long robes and hoods, like the monks of Ulric.
The high priest of the cult of Ulric shrugged and scratched his belly. Talabekland and Middenheim were attentive.
Luitpold, enjoying their regard, continued. They were standing still, but their faces glowed a little, as if lit by lanterns. I would have called out to them to explain their business, but I didn't want to wake everyone. I was suddenly very sleepy, so I returned to my tent. I assumed you would know what they were about.
Oswald looked thoughtful.
Do you suppose my son could have witnessed some apparition? My late father was prone to seeing spirits. The knack could have skipped a generation.
I've heard of no such spectral cadre, said Oswald. There are many stories about the hauntings in these woods. My friend Rudy Wegner, whom you will meet at Castle Drachenfels, knows and has told me of dozens of local legends. But these monks do not mean anything to me.
The Baron von Mecklenburg snorted.
Then you are less well-learned on your own legend than you should be, Ostland. The monks of Drachenfels are widely remembered by necromancers and spirit chasers.
Karl Franz imagined Oswald was discomforted by his fellow elector's knowledge. The Baron poured the last of his tea, hissing into the fire, and continued.
Drachenfels killed many in his time and was enchanter enough to make his sway over his victims last beyond their death. Their spirits clung to him, became his slaves. Some even became his followers. They were supposed to be seen in habits, like monks. Even after their master's death, they are rumoured to cling together, to form an order in the world of ghosts. We travel to the fortress of Drachenfels, and evidently the great enchanter's victims ride with us.
3. Last night, At precisely the worst point, an assistant stage manager had told Detlef, "Things will look better in the morning," and lost 2 front teeth. This morning, when, as expected, things looked even worse than they had been, Detlef vaguely regretted his temper. He had fallen into a swoon just before dawn, and woke up now with a pain in his skinned knuckles. His head ached worse than it had ever done the morning after a drunken orgy, and his mouth felt as if it had been filled with quick-drying slime. The servant, who brought him his breakfast on a tray, had left it at his bedside and not dared to disturb him. He took a mouthful of cold tea, swished it around to clean the scum off his teeth, and spat back into the cup. The bacon and bread were cold and greasy. He took a bite and forced himself to get it down. It all came flooding back horribly. His best friend was a strangely altered monstrosity, and Henrik Crayley claimed he was also the madman who had murdered Rudy Wegner and Manesh the dwarf. He hadn't bothered to undress last night. Now he did, and found fresh clothes laid out for him. He pulled them on, trying to will the fog out of his head. He rubbed his stubbled chin, and decided to put off shaving until his hands were steady enough to hold the razor. Detlef found most of the company gathered in the main hall, peering at a notice posted on the door, signed by Henrik Crayley. It was an announcement that the murderer had been caught, and that things would now proceed normally. Varga Bruegel was not mentioned, and no one had yet noticed he wasn't with them.
"I bet it's that bastard Kaczynski," said a small voice.
"No, it's not," said Kaczynski, hitting someone.
"Where's the vampire?"
asked Justus, the trickster.
"It wasn't her," said Detlef. "Crayley's taken Bruegel."
There were general gasps of disbelief.
"And it wasn't him, either. At least, it's not been proved to my satisfaction. Where is Genevieve?"
No one knew. Detlef found her in her room, dead in her bed. She wasn't breathing, but he felt a slow heartbeat. There was no waking her. Even in his current state of disturbance, he took the time to look around. There were books on her dressing table, written in an arcane form of Bretonian Detlef could just recognise but not follow. Genevieve's diaries? They would make interesting reading. A scarf had been hung over the mirror. It must be strange to lose familiarity with your own face, Detlef supposed. Otherwise the room was like any other woman's. Trunks of clothes, a few pamphlets, keys and coins on the nightstand, an icon-sized portrait of a couple dressed in the styles of 7 centuries ago. There was a copy of the Drachenfels script on a chair, with annotations in a tiny hand. He would have to ask her about that. Was she studying her own part? Lily Nissen's part, rather? When she didn't wake up after a minute or two, Detlef left her to the sleep of the undying. He found Reinhardt Jessner, and told him to take the cast through their lines while he saw to Bruegel. The young actor understood immediately and corralled the company efficiently. There were Crayley-signed notices up all over the fortress, issuing orders and failing to explain the situation. He must have been up all night putting his signature to them. Detlef found them in the stables, which had been converted into a makeshift jail-cum-interrogation room. He was drawn to the place by the noise of the thumps. They'd cleared out one of the stalls and chained Bruegel up, naked, like an animal in it. Crayley sat on a stool asking questions, while an inky clerk with a quill taller than his hat scratched down a transcript of the conversation. Detlef wondered how he transliterated the screams. One of Crayley's halberdiers was naked to the waist, his torso flushed and sweaty. He had armoured gauntlets on and had been working Bruegel over. The prisoner's human face was bloodied. The rest of him leaked a yellowish fluid. Even if Bruegel had had any answers, he wouldn't have been able to give them, Detlef thought.
"What are you doing here, Crayley, you idiot?"
"Getting a confession. The Crown Prince will want things sorted out before he gets here."
"I think if you hit me a couple of times with those gloves on, I'd confess too.
Surely even a crétin like you knows why torture is out of fashion. Unless, of course, you get your amusement this way.
Crayley stood up. He had Bruegel's yellow ichor on his boots and wore an immaculate white cravat. He didn't look as if he had spent the night crawling about secret passageways and leaping to conclusions.
There are details known only to the murderer. Those are what we are after.
And what if he's not the murderer?
Crayley's lips curled up on one side.
I think that's unlikely, given the evidence. Don't you?
Evidence? The killer just stuck his bloody hand on a door to point you to a convenient scapegoat, and you've done just what he wanted. A 9-year-old wouldn't be taken in by that old trick.
The torturer took a good shot at Bruegel's stomach, disturbing the forest of unclassifiable fronds that grew there. Several of the eyes in his chest had been put out. Another of Crayley's men was heating up a brazier and sticking blacksmithing tools into it. Torture was evidently not a lost art in Östland. Detlef wondered how good Prince Oswald would react to all this.
I was not referring to the bloody door, Mr. Sirk. I was referring to this monstrous abortion, this creature of chaos.
Mouths around Bruegel's waist snapped open, long tongues darting out. The torturer cried out,
"That stings!"
Blue wheels rose on his arm.
"You'll be dead in 3 days," said Bruegel,
his voice remarkably unaffected. The torturer started back, raising his hand to strike. Then panic filled his eyes. He grabbed his arm as if to squeeze out the infection.
"You can't possibly know that, Bruegel," Detlef said. "You've never stung anyone before."
Bruegel laughed, liquid rattling in his throat.
"That's true."
The torturer looked relieved and cuffed Bruegel viciously. Blood flew. The floor of the stall was slippery with various bodily fluids. The place smelled badly. The clerk scribbled down a precis of the incident for posterity.
"Crayley, can I talk to my friend?"
The steward shrugged.
"Alone?"
He nodded his head, got up and strolled out of the stall. His torturer went with him, rubbing his itching rash. The scribe also withdrew, muttering about judicial procedures.
"Can I get you anything?" Detlef asked.
"Some water would be nice."
Detlef used a dipper in a bucket that stood nearby and raised the water to his friend's lips. He found it strange being so close to such a twisted creature, but he swallowed his distaste. Bruegel coughed as he slurped, and the water trickled out of his wounded mouth. But his throat worked, and he got some down. He hung there, exhausted in his chains, and looked expectantly at Detlef.
"Go on," he said. "Ask me."
"Ask you what?"
"If I gutted Rudy and took his eyes, and did the same with Manesh."
Detlef hesitated.
"All right, I'll ask you."
Bruegel's eyes leaked again. He looked betrayed.
"You have to say it out loud. It hurts more that way. The hurting is the most important part of it."
Detlef gulped.
"Did you kill them, Rudy and Manesh?"
Bruegel painfully formed a toothless smile.
"Is that what you think?"
"Come on now, Vargar. This is me, Detlef Sirk, not some total stranger. We've worked together for how many years now? You stuck by me all through the history of Sigmar. You think I'm going to desert you?